W1590 AM Denmark, W250 CV Green Bay,
and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Chuck Sievertson. Tougher abortion bans in Nebraska and South Carolina were close but failed. There are heated debates among Republican lawmakers. In South Carolina, the opposition included the state's three Republican women, including State Senator Penry Gustafson.
We do not think it would hold up to the South Carolina Supreme Court, so that's why we rejected it.
Gustafson says the near-total ban left no room for empathy, reality, or graciousness. Montana joins more than a dozen states banning gender-affirming medical care for transgender minors. ABC's Alex Stone.
Gender-affirming care supports an individual's gender identity when it conflicts with their gender at birth. Under the new law, doctors in Montana could have their medical licenses suspended for at least a year, and they can be sued.
The U.S. Army's ordered all its helicopters and planes to stay on the ground temporarily, investigating two deadly helicopter mishaps that killed 12 soldiers within a month. They're almost ready. Their armed forces are, says Ukraine's defense minister, for a counteroffensive against Russia. This is ABC News. Illegal border crossings go up, go down, now they're up again, says Gloria Chavez, chief border patrol agent in Brownsville, Texas.
We start noticing the majority of that uptick is related to Venezuelan nationals, many of them, as you know, who have been waiting south of the river in encampments there.
Cleaning up what's left of their homes and possessions after a tornado hit Hosford in Florida's panhandle yesterday.
A bunch of our windows were blown out. From the roof, there's water leaking through to the bottom.
Ashley Bates was doing laundry, got an alert on her phone. Lily Bates and her fellow eighth graders had just returned from a class trip.
We went to the hallways, did the thing where you put your hands over your head and stuff. I was crying.
Nobody reported hurt from the twister, but a lot of damage. Blaming the airlines for most flight cancellations, Congress's Government Accountability Office. Maintenance and crew issues are things the airlines can control, says the report. Chuck Sievertson, ABC News.
The Talk of Green Bay, 1590 AM and 97.9 FM WGBW programming is broadcast from the Bug Tussle Studios.
Bug Tussle, keeping you connected to the world around you.
For Civic Media, I'm Jane Matmayer. Here's what you need to know. Two railway cars ended up in the Mississippi River after a freight train derailed on Thursday. It happened near DeSoto in Crawford County. The cars floated downstream but got stuck along the shore after passing under the Wisconsin Highway 82 bridge. Officials say the batteries on board are contained and don't pose a threat to the public. At least four employees were hurt. The cause is under investigation. A new proposal looking for a co-sponsor in the Wisconsin legislature would allow victims of child sexual abuse to file civil suits until the age of 45 instead of capping the age at 35. The Child Victims Act, however, does not allow those over 45 to file suit, something that victims and advocates have been requesting for years. I'm Jane Matmayer. This is Civic Media News.
VA has a new life insurance program for veterans with service-connected disabilities called Veterans Affairs Life Insurance, or VA Life. VA Life benefits include up to $40,000 in coverage, no medical questions to enroll, and no time limit to apply if you are age 80 or under. Veterans can apply, receive an instant decision, and manage their policy online. Learn more about VA Life or apply online by visiting va.gov/life-insurance. Protect those who matter most with VA Life Insurance.
This is the story of a very special woman. Just a few knew about her superpowers. In a matter of seconds, she turned herself into a great mathematician. She masqueraded as a regular person at work, but as a superhero at home. Everyone knows her as Gabriella. I still call her Mom.
Your hero needs you now, and AARP is here to help. Find the care guides you need to help, complete with tips and resources, at aarp.org/caregiving. Brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
The Devil's Advocates Radio Show.
He's the gravedigger, Gilbert Brown.
Where can you go where it's always a standard room only? You ain't gonna find that in Chicago.
It's never personal, only politics.
You ain't gonna find that in Minnesota, standing room only, because you can go to the gumball machine, stick a quarter in there, I'll come pick it.
The Devil's Advocates Radio Show.
That's the way it is, man. We love football fans. Fans love us.
Weekdays 4 to 6 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
Moving Day, a walk for Parkinson's, is happening around the country. Together we can unite in the fight against Parkinson's disease in a safe but exciting and fun way. So let's get moving. Join the Parkinson's Foundation to learn more and register at movingdaywalk.org.
Devil's Advocates Radio Show.
He's the Gravedigger, Gilbert Brown.
Where can you go where it's always a standard room only? You ain't gonna find that in Chicago.
It's never personal, only politics.
You ain't gonna find that in Minnesota, standing room only, because you can go to the gumball machine, stick a quarter in there, I'll come ticket.
The Devil's Advocates Radio Show.
That's the way it is, man. We love football fans. Fans love us.
Weekdays 4 to 6 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
You are never far away from your favorite local radio station. We're always streaming on TuneIn and the Civic Media app, and we invite you to get social with us by following our network's Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook pages. Want even more? CivicMedia.us.
And download the podcast and never miss a minute. You're listening to the best of the Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So recently we had AFSCME President Lee Saunders on the program to talk about the sanitation strike, the 1968 sanitation strike in Memphis, and the importance of workers realizing their power and organizing. And look, they're throughout every generation, you know, and I've said this numerous times, every generation has to rediscover what solidarity means to them, find its voice, find its power. And I hope we're living through one of those moments right now that historians are going to look back on and go, hey, you know, this was important. You know, workers finding their power. The question is what lies ahead? And before we can live in the future, we got to look to the past. And that's always helpful. And here to talk about his hot off the presses new book, Under the Iron Heel, The Wobblies and the Capitalist War on Radical Workers. I've asked Ahmad White to come talk with us. He's a professor of law at the University of Colorado Boulder. Professor, thanks for taking time for us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So why did we write this book? This is not something that a lot of people think back to the Wobblies, the IWW, the industrial workers of the world. Not a topic a lot of people get into. What made you write the book?
Oh, there are a number of reasons. I had a longstanding interest in the IWW going back about, 20 years or so. I would say the most outstanding reason I wrote the book was, as one of my close colleagues put it, to pay tribute to these people and to what they tried to accomplish and to what they endured and to give some testament to their experiences, which I think are well worth being remembered.
Now, the short memory that I have of the IWW is the slogan, an injury to one being an injury to all, and the idea of one big union that everyone's in, skilled workers, unskilled workers, white, black, male, female, all of that. And also the 1912 Bread and Roses strike, the textile strike up in Lawrence, Massachusetts, in that area. Those are the two things that pop out. Does that seem about right?
Yeah, that's right. You remember some of the most essential things about this extremely important organization in American history, the Wobblies, as they were universally called, the members of the IWW. Founded their union for an explicitly revolutionary purpose in the summer of 1905. And for about 20 years thereafter, they captivated much of the nation, the working class. Many people embraced them. Hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people supported the union. Hundreds of thousands joined it. And on the other side of that, many people in the ruling class came to despise this organization, and they set out to destroy it.
Yeah, and look, you had the kind of inequality that I would argue we're suffering through today. Jobs obviously were much more difficult back then. The laws hadn't been in place. People were working, 12 sun up to sundown schedules, 6-7 days a week, brutal conditions. A much more brutal era. But, people saying enough is enough already. And I see us in kind of the same kind of environment now where workers have been exploited for far too long. And a lot of people are raising their head going, enough is enough.
That's right. That's one of the many lessons of this story about the IWW and what happened to it 100 years ago is a lesson about determination, about courage and resolve, and the importance of that in challenging the kinds of working conditions that workers all over the world have always faced. Yes, things were very bad at the time the IWW was formed. That's one reason the union was established. And you're right, they're not as bad today, but there's still tremendous inequality in this country. There's still tremendous exploitation, tremendous alienation, insecurity, things like that. And what the Wobblies tried to do and what they endured are important lessons for workers and their supporters today.
Now you saw a lot of organizing coming together, but you also back then you had a lot more, you know, a lot of capital pushback. There were a lot of beatings, a lot of violence, and a lot of using the state as you know, corporate militias, corporate police, if you will, to beat down some of these organizing drives. Any lessons that we should be learning today as we see some of the legislation, some of the laws maybe changing in one way or another? Anything that you see similar between the eras?
I think one of the most important lessons to learn from the IWW is actually a skepticism about the state. When the union was formed, its founders forecast that in short order, they would find themselves under the Iron Heel. The topic, the Iron Heel, being the title of a very famous, at the time, very famous, very popular novel by Jack London.
Right.
The union's members, Jack London himself, forecast that these people who set out to topple capitalism, to create a workers' commonwealth, would be repressed. And at the center of that campaign of repression would be the state. And so the IWW, from the outset, was very, very, very skeptical about the state. And that was one thing that separated them from other major currents of leftism and labor organizing in the early 20th century, the mainstream of the Socialist Party, much of the established labor union movement, trade union movement, as well as the communist movement when that emerged in 1919. The IWW had a very different view of the state. And I think that's something worth thinking about nowadays. Even if you don't go as far as the IWW did,
right,
in rejecting the state in its entirety as a means of reforming the condition of labor or bringing about revolution, I don't think you have to go that far. You might want to, but I don't think you have to go that far to take from this union an important lesson in who controls the state and what the state is liable to do to people who trample on or attempt to compromise the interest of powerful people.
And it's not hard to understand why they thought that way. I mean, if you looked at what happened to the Knights of Labor, you know, just a few years before, you know, they were basically crushed by the state.
That's right. That's right. And it's not a coincidence that some of the founding members of the IWW had experience in the Knights of Labor. Others were veterans of the Western Federation of Miners, an organization of so-called hard rock miners in the western reaches of the United States that had fought labor wars all over the West. So it's not a coincidence that the primary leader of the IWW in its first 20 years of existence or so was a familiar person to some people, William Big Bill Hayward, who was an official in the Western Federation of Miners. When he called to order the convention in Chicago, summer of 1905, that established the industrial workers of the world.
No, I mean, for me, you know, as someone who has a libertarian bent, and I think this is something that, you know, a lot of my, you know, whatever side of the aisle you're on politically, the libertarian streak in us says, you know, I don't want the state, you know, dictating how we have to negotiate. I've always been of the mindset that we win things at the bargaining table. We fight for better wages, hours, conditions, and we enforce them ourselves. And we hold on to those because those things that we fight for, we're not so easy to give up on. And I think that's really been the lesson of the last 50, 60 years is all those fights, you know, Knights of Labor, IWW, you know, CIO forward, those things have been easy to give up because there have been a couple of generations who have been detached from it and didn't have to fight for it, which is why you hear, well, you know, those unions are something we needed 100 years ago, when the reality is workers are getting cheated today.
Well, that's right. And again, another lesson related to some things we've talked about that can be drawn from the IWW's experience and its counsel to workers is how unreliable these legal reforms mediated by the state, administered by the state, can be. I think in some ways, the whole history of the modern labor movement in the United States is a confirmation of that, that how many workers now and workers' allies have come to understand that by bitter experience, the frustrations of dealing with the National Labor Relations Act and the way, yes, it gives workers or protects workers rights to form unions, to engage in strikes and all of that, but it also limits all of those things.
It's an excellent point. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're with Ahmed White. He's a professor of law at the University of Colorado Boulder, also the author of Under the Iron Heel, The Wobblies and the Capitalist War on Radical Workers. You know, this is one of these moments where you go, you look at just what you brought up, the National Labor Relations Act, I believe, was a peace treaty to get, you know, these kind of activist workers out of the streets and back into the negotiating table, which I'm not opposed to. But like you said, things drifted away. And I find it interesting that, you know, the founding of the IWW is the same year of the, you know, the New York Bake Shop Act that began moving us, you know, eventually toward the Lochner era, where we couldn't use those laws anymore. So for me, there's some parallel there. Or do you think I'm just reaching for something here? Because it seems there seems something there to me.
No, there's something very important there. And it's to do with the interesting role, the tragic role that progressivism played in the demise of the IWW and the repression of it. And it's one of the themes in the book that even though there were some progressives who supported the IWW, at least supported its right to exist and helped defend its members against the vicious repression that they faced, progressives were also at the center of this campaign to destroy the IWW, at the same time that they were leading an effort that I think ultimately culminated with the National Labor Relations Act and the New Deal period to reform the world of work, to institute legal reforms that would make the workplace essentially better in some ways without ever challenging the basic structures of power and control in American society and in the American workplace. So the Wobblies' history and the history of the destruction of the union in the 19-teens and 1920s is entwined with the rise of progressivism and the rise of reformism.
An interesting book. I hope folks will take a look at it. Under the Iron Heel, The Wobblies and the Capitalist War on Radical Workers. We'll get links out on social media how you can pick that up. Powell's Books, most certainly a place you can go. You can also go to ahmedwhite.org. We'll get links out on that as well. So last line of questioning I've got for you. After writing this book, what are you hoping people take from it? When working people read this, what's the message that you want them to take away from?
You know, I suppose the most important thing that one can take from it is a sense of pride. If you are a worker, if you're part of the labor movement, if you're a person of the left, this to me was a tremendous story of resolution, of determination and courage, of audacity, and of workers standing up for themselves. And I think, especially if one is a worker or a unionist, leftist, there is something here worth reading about and an opportunity to see in what happened to these people 100 years ago, a broader affirmation of unions, of workers, of the central aims of the American left.
Or just of working people wanting a better future for themselves and their families. You know, for me, it's that story of striving to have better, you know, families, better communities, better opportunities. All of that seems to play into this for me. And, you know, in reading some of the through some of it, you know, I identify with it with a good bit of what they were moving forward to. And I hope folks will take a look at it. And maybe some of the ideas will spring forward and help us move forward as well.
I hope so.
Ahmed White, I appreciate you taking time for us. Thanks so much. The book, Under the Iron Heel, The Wobblies and the Capitalists, War on Radical Workers. Again, we'll get links out on social media how you can take a look at that. Ahmed, I appreciate the time.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Going to take a quick break. Want to get your thoughts? Email me, Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. Back after this. Stick around. Listening to the best of The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to TheRickSmithShow.com.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
You're listening to the best of The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
You know, I like these books talking about labor's past, because I think the more we learn from the struggles of the past, the easier the future will be. And it drives me crazy when people go, no, we don't need those stinking unions. You know, that was something we needed 100 years ago. Yeah, I needed them 100 years ago. Absolutely right. You need them again. It seems simple to me, which is why it's interesting. I got an email from Brenda, listening on WIOO 97.9 in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, asked quite pointedly, why would anyone join a union? And this is what blows my mind. I don't know why anyone would ask that question. I mean, the simple answers are, well, you know, collective bargaining agreements that get you better wages, hours, conditions, you know, higher salaries, better benefits, that kind of stuff. Job security, the end of at-will employment. You have to be fired for cause. There has to be a reason for you to lose your job. Seniority rights, that kind of stuff. But, you know, also, you know, safer working conditions. But for me, it's that empowerment, that sense that you have a say in the destination of your life, that you can. That your voice matters. But I appreciate the email, Brenda. And I don't understand why you would ask the question, but I'm glad you did. Let's go to the phones. Got Alice on one. Alice, how are you?
I'm insane.
Okay.
So, yeah, you know, nothing new about that. You were saying at the beginning of the show, talking about Ted Cruz and his pushing lies and propaganda about abortion. And the thing that really gets me is, these are supposed to be, and you'll notice I said supposed, to be educated people. And they are fulfilling being public servants. And they're also telling us over and over about how they love Jesus, and, you know, it's all about Christianity and those Ten Commandments. And if I recall correctly, one of them is about you're not supposed to lie. But yet, they seem to think nothing about lying because we all know that we don't do abortions after a child is born, because that wouldn't be an abortion. That would be murder.
Yeah, but again, they understand, Ted Cruz knows, he knows what the law is. Ted Cruz knows exactly what he's doing. As I've said before, you know, is it worse that someone knows that they're lying to you or actually truly believes it? I think Ted Cruz is one of the worst people on the planet, because I know he knows better. But he does it because this is about, you know, as you said, you know, the Ten Commandments, there's a couple of them he's breaking there, you know, the bearing false witness and the idolatry, you know, the worshiping of money, because this really is about wealth and power. This is about campaign cash. This is about keeping him in the power position. He doesn't believe this stuff, but it's good rhetoric to inflame the poorly educated.
Well, it is. And, you know, it really bothers me that, and ignorance abounds. All these people going, well, you know, the heartbeat bill, 6 weeks. Well, riddle me this. How can you have a heartbeat when a heart in a fetus does not form until around the fifth month? So, you know, it just shows how uneducated apparently the entire Republican Party is. But there's nothing new about that. They're right on my list along with West Virginia. But, you know, we'll not go there. Have a good evening, Rick.
Thank you, Alice. I appreciate it. No, and look, you know, this again is my problem with the moment that we're in. None of this is about solutions. Understand this. It's not about solutions. It's not about fixing things. It's not about moving forward. It's about continuing the fight and the struggle to keep us apart so that they can continue to move what their real agenda is. And the real agenda, and this isn't conspiratorial, it just is. It's more for the rich and powerful, more money, more wealth, more power, more all of that, and less for you and me. And the thing that they dance in front of us every chance they get to keep us distracted from the fact that enormous amounts of wealth have been stolen from the working class of this country is this stupid stuff. You know, I had someone ask me, you know, why I care. I go, I don't. I mean, this is the problem. I really don't care about these issues. Honestly, I mean, you know, the same-sex marriage doesn't matter to me. It doesn't matter, affect my life at all. But someday I may know somebody, and that matters. I grew up in a time, and I guess this just means being Gen X. I grew up in a time where, you know, don't worry about me, worry about yourself. You minded your own business. As long as it doesn't cost me anything. You know, I had someone say, well, will you use pronouns? I go, no, I'm not going to put pronouns in my signature. If you can't tell I'm a man, well, that's on you. But if someone tells me, hey, I go by this pronoun, I'm going to try. I'm going to try and use whatever pronoun they want, whatever name they want, because it's respectful. It's being decent. And the sad reality is that whole thing that our parents taught us, or at least my mother taught me, was to be decent, to be respectful. You know, that golden rule, treat others as you'd want them to treat you, or, you know, the silver one, treat them as poorly as you would want them to treat you as poorly. But we've got a whole political class right now hell-bent on, again, keeping us enraged at each other. On any topic, it's life or death. And with social media, the trolling is, most of it is just, I don't think people who actually understand or care about the issue, it's just about making someone else as miserable as they are. This is why I believe in face-to-face conversations. You know, I get vile stuff from people via email, via social media, vile stuff. Stuff I know if I took to their mother and said, do you know your child wrote this? The mother would wash their mouth out with soap. At least my mother would have. But we're not that society anymore. And it's because we've got bad leaders. It's hard to believe that someone like Sheldon Whitehouse, a good, decent man, is in the same institution as Ted Cruz. Hard for me to believe. And the reality is, I look at Cruz, Ivy League educated, brilliant guy. I guess he's argued before the Supreme Court. He's at the top of the heap, you know, credential wise. Spreading lies and misinformation for political gain. He's a huckster. he's in the same world as someone like Trump. And until we, you, me, us, put down this nonsense, we're going to continue to get ripped off. And nothing for us gets done. Yeah, issue after issue. There are solutions. There are solutions. And I believe we can find them. The problem is the other side, they don't want solutions. They want division. They want destruction. They want anger. They want animosity. They want us to keep the red hats and the blue hats on. They want us buying their t-shirts and their bull. Time for us to stop. Almost swore there. Quick break, right back. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1975. That was the day the AFL-CIO held a Jobs Now rally in Washington, D.C. A painful recession had pushed unemployment in the U.S. to 9%. Many workers across the nation thought the Ford administration was not doing enough to address the needs of working families. 60,000 people, many of them union members carrying banners representing their unions, gathered in RFK Stadium. There they heard speeches, including one from Senator Hubert H. Humphrey, who had served as vice president under Lyndon B. Johnson. His speech described the devastating impact of unemployment. Senator Humphrey said, "Our nation must recommit itself to the goal and the promise of full employment, a job for every American who is willing and able to work. Perhaps we would get bolder action and more compassion from this administration if some of its top advisors had a little taste of unemployment themselves. Perhaps they would know what unemployment is. It's drawing your last unemployment check with no job in sight. It's sitting in the dark to save on the light bill. It's making shoes last another month and driving on bald tires. It's eating a little less so the kids can eat a little more. It's facing eviction because you can't pay the rent or meet the mortgage. It's borrowing from your brother-in-law or letting your insurance lapse. It's facing yourself in the mirror and asking why and how much longer. It's wondering how a nation this rich, this enterprising, this great can let more than 8 million Americans who want to work and need to work go without work." Some protesters rushed the stage at the rally, causing it to end early. But his questions still remain. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com. Like us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter at laborhistoryin2.
Do you find it as charming as I do when some leisure class corporate chieftain whines that America's working stiffs are a bunch of slackers? We're hearing that now from Wall Street plutocrats, grumping that employees no longer have that old nose-to-the-grindstone, yes-boss work ethic of old-school capitalism that has created such fabulous wealth. Of course, wealth for whom and work for what are at the root of today's questioning of the old culture and structure of work. But the grumpers don't want to hear that, so they simply carp that America has gone soft. The latest high-flying scolder is Stephen Ratner, the Wall Street huckster who was fined $6 million in 2010 for running a kickback scheme and banned from investment banking for 2 years. But now he's back in the financial hustle, feeling free to chastise you for what he sees as your lack of hustle on the job. In particular, Steve is peeved at you work-from-home people, asserting with no actual evidence that you're not really working. He claims it will inevitably lead to a lower standard of living, a standard he measures strictly in money, not quality of life. Indeed, he says that your life should be work, pointing with envy to China's 996 system, a grinding ethic of expecting people to work from 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. 6 days a week. Then, Ratner offers a grand solution to dissuade work-from-home arrangements, housing. Why, he asks, have a big majority of European workers already returned to their offices? Simple, he says, most people there live in small apartments and houses, making stay-at-home work less comfortable. Voila! Put America's workers in tiny houses and office space will fill up. This is Jim Hightower saying, see, life is simple if you view it from the heights of Wall Street. Thank you, Steve. Now, go away.
You're listening to the best of The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to therickSmithShow.com.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
Evidently, Fox News, this is getting better and better every day with this Tucker Carlson thing. The blue check mark mafia on Twitter, they're all on board. Wherever Tucker goes next, they're going to be there. In fact, they were sharing a picture of him laughing, playing golf. But I loved the Rolling Stone report that said, evidently Fox News executives have a dossier. There's a dossier. Evidently it's got a bunch of dirt on Tucker Carlson that, he'll stay in line. He's not going to do anything stupid. They've got the dirt. Wow. I mean, you couldn't write this stuff, to be honest. I mean, Netflix wouldn't pick this show up. Anyway, here to share some thoughts on the top stories of the day from India, our good friend, former Ohio congressman and political analyst, Bob Ney. Bob, thanks for taking time for us.
Namaste, Rick. How are you?
I am great. How are things in India?
Pretty good. They like us, and it's a world's largest democracy. It will exceed the population of China, I think, within a year or two. So things are pretty good. Let's see. The American hotel chains that are $220 a night are $53 a night here. How about that?
Wow.
Yeah, gas is high, but rest of the products have stayed relatively low, but that's because the buying power. I mean, you know, if you raise the prices too much, they're simply not going to sell here. People aren't going to buy them.
Right. So, yeah. No, I know. I know you like going there. I know that's your
getaway.
Your mental health space. Let's use that.
It is. It's pretty peaceful over here. I went to Northern India with Ellen Ratner. Of course, who got me started on India? Right.
Yeah.
Ellen Ratner, our friend Ellen.
Yeah, I miss
Ellen. That's how 12 years ago.
Yeah. So any thoughts on the insanity that's going on here as Kevin McCarthy and the Republicans passed their the Limit, Save and Grow Act, otherwise known as the Let's Shoot the Hostages Act. Any thoughts going on there of how insane we are?
Well, I mean, it's more insane what Fox News is happening for the spicy side of news with Fox, but this is creating its own problems. Here's a couple of observations I like to make on this. One, from the very start, what's the kind of main headline on this beyond what it does or beyond where it's going to go? Here's the main headline. I find this, if I were the speaker, I would find this troublesome, to say the least. Four Republicans went against it. He only had one vote to spare. It was 217 to 215. You know, here's sort of the headlines is that, you know, McCarthy beats his caucus. They don't say that, but he defeats his caucus. He wins. That in itself,
yeah,
to make the observation that, wow, McCarthy, he's a leader because he just got his own caucus to support the debt ceiling bill. In itself, what does that tell you, Rick? You're one of the best retail political people I know. Tells you he's got a problem.
Yeah. No, like I said at the beginning, and I said, you know, if this bill had any chance of passing, and it doesn't, I say maybe 50 people vote for it.
Mm-hmm. Right. Right.
Because so it's that bad. When you're talking about a 22% cut to the VA, when you're talking about a 22% cut to the Social Security Administration, when you're talking these kind of massive draconian cuts, that's going to hurt your constituents, and they know that.
Right. So this was a, and for some people, by the way, this is a, in the Republican caucus, because, you know, I was in that caucus, this is going to serve as a safety net for them, believe it or not. You know, some people, Marjorie Taylor, you know, Green, Marjorie Taylor, three names, it's going to serve as a safety cushion for them, because they're going to say, hey, I voted. You know, I voted to do the right thing. Can't help what the rest of the system does.
Yeah.
So for some of them, it'll be that. For others, this is going to be a vote that, of course, will be used against them. Here's the number one thing about this piece of legislation, and it's not inherently what's in it as much as it should never exist. You raise debt ceilings. I did it multiple times when Bush was president. We did it when Clinton was president. You raise or you don't raise debt ceilings. You don't do a budget in a debt ceiling bill. Why? This is such 101 politics, 101 government, 101 sociology. They are voting on what has already happened.
I know.
They're codifying what already went down last year.
And then taking on the arrows of what I argue a budget being a moral document and a document of priorities by sticking it to veterans and seniors.
Right. Yes, they did. So, the substance in itself is not good with anything they've done with seniors or veterans. But also to attempt to do a budget in a debt ceiling bill is just, it's politically bizarre. Why do you want to put your members on a mark here? Some of the members that voted for this, now the four that didn't, of course, Matt Gaetz of Florida didn't vote for it because it didn't make people work 15 hours a day for $2 an hour, you know, for food stamps. So yeah, that's Matt Gaetz' thinking. But why would you want to put your members on the line? Why would you want to vote for this when it's not even a budget process? You argue all these things out in the 11 or 13 appropriation bills, depends how they craft them. You argue all of these things out, Rick, as you know, the old way we used to do it, line by line, budget item by budget item, and an amendment process. This wasn't an amendment process on where you stood on veterans. You know, this was just a cut.
Yeah.
So the whole thing's bizarre. And then on top of it, to have the story of how, you know, the speaker was finally able to, you know, maneuver, push, threaten, wrangle, whatever you want to call his own caucus to barely survive by one vote.
Yeah, but I keep coming back to the main point. He got them to vote for something that's never going to become law. It's never going to pass. The president said he's going to veto it, and I don't think it gets through the Senate, even if it does.
Right. This was a pre-budget statement to satisfy a lot of members of the Freedom Caucus. That's what this was, a pre-budget statement, because it should never have happened this way. So he was satisfying them. But the whole thing is going wrong from the substance of the bill, the cuts that it incurred without debate for the veterans and seniors, without debate. And people say, well, the bill is debated. No, these are complicated line items dealing with veterans and seniors and domestic spending and defense and everything else under the sun, and you don't do it in a bill that just says, oh, here's our numbers, here we go. It's not the way it's done in the debt ceiling bills.
Yeah, so, but you used the word
there.
And this
also, by the way, gives no leverage to them with the president.
Yeah, none. I mean, there's nothing there.
None.
But you used the word complicated, which is a complicated word that they don't understand. I mean, I have, you know, friends who are like, governing is easy. You know, being a legislator is easy. No, it's a lot of hard work. It's a lot of compromise if you do it right. What we're seeing is it being done wrong.
Correct. The whole process, you're right, Rick, is done wrong. When we did these budgets years back, we dug in, we, Republicans and Democrats, dug in, I mean, line item by line item. You know, how is this working in health and human services? How did this work in veterans? It allowed you actually to do some things like saying, hey, you know, the VA bureaucratic system's not working fast enough. Let's put an amendment in there for them to speed up the process for veterans approval. You can do all those things if you do it in the right format and the right way, which is the budget process.
Yeah, that takes too
long. So they have short-circuited all of that.
That takes too long. It's easy just to have a performative bill that we ram through so that we can go back to our podcast circuit and our F channel and say, we tried, but they stopped us.
Right. So this is a non-starter. Here we go. Where do we end up? Is this going to be high noon? And here's the other point. How do you now, as Republican caucus, how do you yield to do something, you know, to avert the shutdown? Or you let the shutdown occur, and then it's sort of like Iraq. What was our exit plan? Oops, we didn't have one, you know? And that's what's going to happen with the Republicans. If you don't have an exit plan, you know, because they know this is not going to make it. They know it has no hope. So what's the exit plan? I don't know. Is it the exit plan punt when we get there?
No, the exit plan is blame Biden. That's always the plan. In a little over a month and a half, or I guess not even a month and a half yet, there's a very real you know, consequence at the end of this road. One that we've never done before. Have we defaulted before?
Well, we shut down the government, which is different than the default.
Yeah, no, we've never actually pushed the button and gone nuclear option.
Right, and that's part of the problem, because a lot of people that are watching this that, you know, aren't up to speed on what D.C. is really doing will view this as, when this happens, or if it happens, or when, they'll view it as a, quote, shutdown. We've shut down before. You know, I was part of that years back, and it's happened a couple times, but the default is completely different. And then that takes our rating. Also, I'll tell you who would be most happy if we defaulted is China.
Yeah.
They want their currency to be the one that rules, not the dollar. They would love it if we would default. It would play right into them trying to take over the currency. So, yes, this would be historic. And as they near towards it, again, if they don't have an exit plan, in normal cases, when I would do news over the last 12 years, right, and I would say, oh, here we go. You know, here's the hype. We're to the edge of the diving board. You know, do we shut down? Do we not shut down?
The bomb's ticking.
Right, here we go. Oh, the brave Senate and the brave House. And then they do a continuing resolution, and, you know, and we all move on. And we all knew the drama was there. This time is different. You're right. This time it might be the real deal.
That's why I keep saying they want to shoot the hostage, just because it's never been done before. They want the chaos. And I've got people going, you know, my 401k was so much better under Trump. If Republicans get their way right now, your 401k is going to look a lot worse.
There's the other thing. In the height of, you know, our times now, and with, you know, continued gasoline increases, thank you, Saudi Arabia, and with inflation, you know, the job market back and forth, good, a little mild. I mean, with all these factors going on, this is surely not the time to even tempt this.
No,
not at all.
It's crazy. Absolutely crazy. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're here with Bob Ney, former Ohio congressman, political analyst, sharing some thoughts from India. And thank you for calling in and sharing some thoughts.
Sure.
I want to get your thoughts before you go on what's going on in Florida with DeSantis and Disney. This just seems crazy on really kind of a bizarre level. You've got DeSantis, who's got some war on woke, whatever that is. I guess, you know, even his people say, you know, being decent, this war on decency, and taking it to Disney. And now Disney's filing a lawsuit against them. Any thoughts on how crazy this is?
Yeah, I haven't looked into, you know, all the details of the history of this relationship. When I say this relationship, Florida and Disney, friends of mine have pointed out you really ought to look into some of the past, you know, ability of Disney to become its own zoning authority. And there's all these intricacies. I guess it's sort of like comparable if you're in Ohio and you're a lawmaker and you're dealing with Honda, right?
Right.
You know, which came to Ohio, and it's a big deal in Ohio. This one, I mean, Walt Disney and Florida are so intertwined, you know, and they've got this lawsuit, you're right. And they are alleging the Republican governor has waged a relentless campaign to weaponize, this is interesting, Disney's using this weaponized government power to use it over the company's head. And so this suit, I think, what this suit does, Rick, is it takes the whole behind the scenes and front scenes of the DeSantis-Disney feud, and it's taking it and it's putting it on a high-speed train, you know, and it's throwing it right out front, because the lawsuit was filed the same day that the DeSantis-backed board moved to undo a development deal that it says Disney struck to show how powerful it is. So the board was going to undo that deal. So I think that this escalates everything that's been going on between DeSantis and Disney, and it throws it also right out front. Now, the question I ask in my mind is Disney, you know, do they have clean hands, like Judge Judy says, you know, to do these suits? Why would a corporation like Disney throw this out right in front of the public, unless, if you look at this, it probably looks better than he does if it comes public, right?
Yeah, I'm, and I got to think of the laws on Disney's side. I mean, you know, to a certain extent, because, you know, there's a part of me that goes, you know, isn't this kind of singling out one entity? And I know there's some, you know, there's some language in our Constitution about singling, in enforcing laws against, you know, individuals, or I don't know. There seems to be, you know, some gray area here that could be interesting to watch how it gets fought out.
True. And it's been back and forth over the years before DeSantis with Disney and how powerful should it be? How much should it do on its own of zoning? How much Florida has to be involved with? And now, you know, the match that lit this was the fact that this DeSantis-backed board said to Disney, no, you can't do that deal. But yeah, the fight really began last year when Disney came out against the Florida bill, which is it's been dubbed Don't Say Gay bill. And they came out against it, and that absolutely, you know, DeSantis went wild with that and went after Disney for speaking against the bill.
You know, for me, it's going to be interesting because, you know, Republicans believe corporations are people. And as I understand, 14th Amendment, you know, gives you the, you know, this equal protection clause that, you know, they can't go after you and enforce. There's an interesting legal argument that I hope Disney pursues.
Well, they are, because the panel that DeSantis, you know, created and, you know, put the people on board, because this was the last straw for Disney. Okay, the panel unanimously voted to declare Disney void and unenforceable for their development deal. Now, that development deal was approved before DeSantis replaced the Disney-approved board with his people.
Right.
So here you have this is striking. Here you have a board that's created to kind of have this oversight of Disney. Disney brings a proposal, a deal. The board says yes. DeSantis replaces board members, and the board then says what? No.
No.
And it was investing $17 billion over the next decade. $17 billion. Here's the stats, Rick. Over the next decade, this deal yielding 13,000 new jobs, right, on top of its more than 75 current cast members, you know, these were permanent jobs. And so what the deal that was approved did then was to be disapproved. I don't see how Disney loses.
Well, maybe the Fox settlement won't be.
Might be small.
Yeah, well, we will see. Bob, I appreciate the time. As always, enjoy your time in India. I appreciate you.
Okay.
You coming around. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Our good friend Bob Ney. You know, seriously, this is going to be at least entertaining. And you know, maybe it's one of the things that, wouldn't it be ironic if Disney is what brought DeSantis down? No, wait a minute. Not DeSantis brought himself down. Never mind. I'm not going to give Disney that credit. Quick break. Right back to wrap things up.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. In 1948, gold was discovered at John Souter's mill in California. As word spread, fortune seekers from all across the United States and across the world flocked to California in what became known as the Gold Rush. This included thousands from China. Many of the Chinese miners planned to return home with the gold they mined. As the easily accessible gold became more and more scarce due to the rush, resentment grew against foreign miners. In 1850, California passed the Foreign Miners Tax, charging those who came from outside the United States $20 a month. On this day in labor history, the year was 1862. The California legislature passed an act to further limit Chinese miners. The official title was An Act to Protect Free White Labor Against Competition with Chinese Coolie Labor and to Discourage the Immigration of the Chinese into the state of California. The word coolie referred to unskilled laborers from China and the Indian subcontinent. It was also often used as a derogatory term for Chinese people. The act implemented new taxes and licensing requirements on Chinese miners. The steep taxes led many Chinese to leave mining. Nearly 12,000 Chinese workers found employment with the construction of the Transcontinental Railroad.
They performed extremely dangerous work, laying the track through the Rocky Mountains. Yet, when the railroad project was completed, the Chinese workers were excluded from the celebrations. They were also not allowed to ride on the trains that crossed the continent for the first time. Anti-Chinese racism continued to grow. 20 years after the passage of the California law, the federal government passed the Chinese Exclusion Act. This law prohibited the immigration of Chinese labor. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com. Well, here's a shocker. And you knew this was going to happen. The MAGA movement, wildly unpopular, obvious, evidently. Latest NBC News poll finds that the MAGA folks, least popular group. Evidently, just 24% of Americans in this poll had a positive view, while 45% have a negative view. Republicans, however, when you look at those numbers, and this is surprising, 52% of Republicans had a positive view of the MAGA folk. That's interesting, as well as 53% of the people who define themselves, stake the flag in the ground as conservative. On the Trump front, Trump is wildly disliked by swing voters. Evidently, you know, Biden has a 39-point lead with swing voters, 54 to 15. Because, you know, they may dislike Biden, but they really dislike Trump. And this is one of those things where you just go, I know Democrats want Trump to run for real, to run so that Biden can win, because we'll see. But it's interesting that Republicans want Trump even more now, which, you know, great. You know, good for you. You keep pushing them. 63% in the most recent Marist poll say that they want Trump to have a second term, even with all of the stuff that's going on, even if he's guilty of the crimes. Yeah. My favorite quote of the day, Carrie Lake, the failed Arizona gubernatorial candidate, she said that Fox News is in bed with the left because they fired Tucker. How dare they? And speaking of Fox News, interesting little back and forth between Brian Kilmeade, who I can't stand, and Rona McDaniel, who I don't trust. Evidently, you know, while being interviewed by Kilmeade, McDaniel said President Trump never shies away from a debate, even though Trump's kind of leaning towards no debates. And Kilmeade goes, yes, he does. He skipped ours in 2016. He did? Well, he skipped one. I love that back and forth. And finally, another neighbor. This time a 79-year-old guy angry with his neighbor for doing yard work. Yes, the guy had a leaf blower. He's out, you know, leaf blowing, and the 79-year-old guy goes out with a gun, shoots him in the head. The 59-year-old dead, 79-year-old being carted away. And this, again, is another one of those moments where, explain to me how guns make us safer. And you go, but Rick, this is an isolated incident. Seems to be happening a lot lately. Old white guys angry about stuff. I don't know. There seems to be some kind of a weird pattern going on. Back in the old days, I remember people pulling out guns and, you know, it's kind of a threat thing. You should go away. You should stop. And but not really using them as often. Today, it seems like we're doing it a lot. It seems we're doing it a lot. And the question then is, you know, what do you do with a 79-year-old guy? By the time he gets to trial, he's probably going to be dead anyway. What punishment is there? Now, this family is going to lose a husband, a father, a breadwinner. They're chaos. And for what? For what? Another senseless killing. And what's interesting is, you know, I had someone email me the other day and say, you know, the most dangerous places in the country, you know, one of the most dangerous places, Memphis, Tennessee. I didn't know that. Tacoma, Washington. Didn't know that. What about Chicago? No. What about New York? No. Those are actually fairly safe places. In fact, you know, red states are some of the most dangerous places in the country, they tell me. And they're the ones who have the guns. And again, I keep asking that question. When do we get to peak safety again? When do we get the neighbors not shooting each other? I know. Good guy with a gun. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. You got anything on your mind? Something I said got under your skin? Angry hate emails I answer first. If you miss any portion of the program, make sure you grab the podcast. Wherever you find your favorite podcasts, you'll find ours. Appreciate you tuning in. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to the talk of Green Bay.
WGBW 1590 AM Denmark. W250 CV Green Bay.
And always streaming on the Civic
ABC
Media
News
app.
I'm